Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Your radio is not deceiving you. I'm here in the big chair on a Saturday evening, not my usual spot in the rotation. But I volunteered to fill in for my colleague George Norrie, and I'm very glad to be with you on such a glorious late spring evening. If you've listened to any of the previous programs on Coast that I've hosted over the years, or if you live in Nevada and have seen work I do in my day job on television, then you know how I feel about animal welfare issues. I've covered them for as long as I've been a journalist, everything from wild horses to performing bears, wolves, coyotes, reptiles, lions, tigers, ligers, abused dogs and abandoned cats, circus elephants, sharks slaughtered for soup, chimpanzees tortured in the name of science, and a litany of horrors that are largely hidden from view by those gargantuan factory farms that work very hard to make sure that you, the consumers, never see the immense cruelty that is packed into every bite, every steak, every pork chop, every hamburger and egg and chicken wing. It is, as we've argued previously on this program, a conspiracy, and it affects all of us every time we go to the grocery store or a restaurant or cook a meal for ourselves or our loved ones. And most of us don't think about how our food is produced. It's as if ham grows on the ham tree, and, you know, it gets plucked when it's ripe. We don't think about it. And oftentimes that's on purpose. There's our entire industries that don't want us to think about it. Seems like every time we tackle these issues on Coast generates a huge response from you listeners, because we explore things that are generally not made public, not in nightly newscasts or in your morning newspaper, not in any detail anyway. And in years past, when we've tackled this conspiracy of silence and the disturbing issues associated with it, it always seems like it's an uphill battle, that there's little any of us can do to force these factory farms, these giant agribiz conglomerates, to be more humane, or to shine a spotlight on these horrific practices that are the bedrock of these massive food conglomerates, or to get the big entertainment giants to stop imposing lives of misery on intelligent creatures from elephants to orcas. Animal welfare activist Sir Paul McCartney, who, by the way, celebrates his birthday today, said you can judge a man's true character by the way he treats his fellow animals. And I think Gandhi said something similar about how to judge the greatness of a nation. And if that is the case, then we all have a ways to go. But it's not all doom and gloom. Some remarkable progress has been made on several fronts, largely because of the work of the people we're going to hear from tonight and their allies. And this is stuff that directly affects everyone who's listening to this program, certainly everyone who cares about the humane treatment of animals. In the first half of the program tonight, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S., Wayne Pacelli, returns to talk about this apparent, what feels like a sea change that's underway, the power of animal welfare advocates, regular people who have let companies, corporations, and political leaders know how they feel about everything from trophy hunting to medical experiments on animals to cruelty and egg production, these meat factories, and other horrific places that put your health at risk, as well as the well-being of animals. Mr. Pacelli has a new book called The Humane Economy, which explains how free market forces have come into play to change things on a fundamental level. What's happened in just the past year is pretty astounding, but there's a ways to go. In the second half of the program, the heated debate about trophy hunters. Remember that dentist who traveled to Africa and shot the Cecil, the beloved lion, the furor that caused? People are still debating the merits or lack thereof of trophy hunting. We'll hear from one of the foremost authorities on these issues, Masha Kalinya, who will join us in hour three. Then in hour four, another contentious arena, horses, both wild and domestic, including racehorses. What happens to horses in this country? Should we be eating them? A lot of people say yes. Marty Irby and Holly Gann are not in agreement with that position. They'll update us on several contentious issues where they could use your help involving horses. A lot of material to cover. Two quick news notes. Quite a weekend so far in Las Vegas. Two spectacles came to town this weekend. EDC, Electric Daisy Carnival. Have you heard of this? This gigantic electronic dance extravaganza, which I think by the end of the weekend, there'll be 300,000 people that came to town for this thing. Sure looks like a lot of fun, but what a wild scene that is. And also in town today, presidential candidate Donald Trump gave a speech at Treasure Island, attracted a large crowd of very enthusiastic supporters and a crowd of protesters outside, mostly peaceful, unlike some of the other stops along the campaign trail that we've seen on television lately. Trump told the crowd one interesting thing. He said he thinks, quote, Bernie Sanders is as crazy as a bedbug, but he, Trump, thinks Sanders is still sticking in the race because the FBI is investigating Hillary Clinton, the implication being maybe Clinton will be indicted and drop out, and then Sanders can be the nominee. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Highly entertaining stuff, though. Our webmaster, Sean, and I have put together a collection of oddities and news items culled from various places. Several of the stories in tonight's NAPS news relate to animal topics. A heartbreaking video which addresses the question of whether chimpanzees feel grief. Also, some advice on humane travel, how to make sure your vacation doesn't inflict cruelty on animals. And a story about something strange that's been detected messing with the rings of Saturn. No, it's not aliens. It's probably not aliens anyway. A few other stories you can find on the Coast website under NAPS News. And also while you're there, check out how to become a Coast Insider. Still a great deal, pennies a day, and you can listen to the program anytime you want, as often as you want, on any device. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog, fluff up a pillow for the cat, put on a pot of Joe, jump into those jammies, turn down the lights, and turn up your radio, because we're ready to rumble. And in a moment, the cutting edge of animal welfare issues, Wayne Pacelli, and the humane economy. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. As with any war, the fight for animal welfare is undertaken in the trenches, and most of us never see the battle, never see the wounds that are inflicted or the arms that are twisted or the tactics that are used. In his new book, The Humane Economy, Wayne Pacelli lays it all out. It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the Humane Society and other animal welfare organizations have carried this fight to their enemies, how they managed to achieve progress, sometimes an inch at a time, sometimes in big chunks. It's a fascinating exploration of issues that touch each of us. I've read it twice now, and I've learned so much about things that I thought I knew. Wayne Pacelli, the CEO and president of the Humane Society of the U.S., the nation's largest animal protection organization, is back. It's good to have you back, Wayne.
George, I'm glad to be with you. You're a fabulous advocate for animals.
Let's talk about the general premise before we get into specifics. The book is great, The Humane Economy. Talk to me about the overarching umbrella issues here, how consumers and pro-animal consumers have been able to affect change by, in essence, voting with their dollars.
Well, a lot of people, when they think of animal treatment issues, they may think of dogs and cats in their homes or their communities. They might think of puppy mills, maybe dog fighting. What I talk about in the Humane Economy and what I work on at the Humane Society of the United States is the broadest set of issues dealing with humans' interactions with animals. And that leads us into the biggest sectors of the economy, food and agriculture, where there are billions of animals used for food, for pork and beef, and then even for milk and eggs. The use of animals in science, animal testing for cosmetics, for chemicals, for pesticides, for medical research, wildlife management issues, trophy hunting and commercial trapping, horses used for horse racing but also killed for human consumption, horses who are injured for showing purposes with Tennessee walking horses where they injure their feet. I mean, these are an incredibly wide range of issues, and what's happening across the board is a growing consciousness about animals, that we are now increasingly alert to the fact that these animals have their own lives that matter to them, that animals suffer, they think, they problem solve, they demonstrate all sorts of cognitive capacities that we as a species denied for decades, partly as a way to ease our conscience about doing some awfully bad things to them. And what I talk about in my book, The Humane Economy, is how the biggest food companies, Walmart, McDonald's, are now embracing animal welfare and saying, we've got to change our purchasing practices because we can't draw products from factory farms where the animals are kept in cages or crates barely larger than their bodies and, you know, can't move for their entire lives. That cosmetic companies are now saying, we're going to go cruelty-free in terms of our testing methods because we know the public doesn't want us dipping substances into the eyes of rabbits or poisoning dogs or rats or guinea pigs. I mean, it's happening across the board, and I think as you noted in your setup, George, it's not just one sector of the economy. It's food, it's science, it's wildlife management, it's fashion, it's the use of live animals in entertainment. All of these things are changing.
You know, you were here a year ago, and there were hints that you were on the verge of some really big breakthroughs, talking, negotiating with some big corporations, food companies in particular. I can't imagine that when you started working on this book, you knew where things were going to lead, that it would change this much by the time you finished. But in the last year, so much has happened. It feels like a tipping point has been reached, or am I reading too much into it?
No, you've got it exactly right. And, you know, as I was writing the book, things were unfolding, and I kept having to go to my publisher, HarperCollins, and say, listen, I need to do some rewriting here because some major developments have occurred. I mean, really, within the last 10 months, 175 of the biggest brand names in food retail, I mean, every big fast food company you can think of, McDonald's, Burger King, Hardee's, Wendy's, the biggest names in grocery stores, like Kroger and Safeway, obviously, you know, previously Whole Foods, Wegmans, the biggest names in food service, Sodexo, Aramark, all of these companies have said they're going to start sourcing cage-free eggs. And eventually they're going to go exclusively cage-free over the next few years because we at the Humane Society of the U.S. and other groups have identified a production practice that is so fundamentally inhumane that it's a brand risk for these companies to continue to work with producers who are doing these terrible things to laying hens. Now, you know, a lot of people think, well, a chicken, you know, it's just a chicken. Well, you know, chickens are breathing, living creatures like so many others, and their lives matter. And if we can do something in a better way, why shouldn't we do so? And the conventional production practice in the egg industry was to jam 6 or 8 birds in a small cage about the size of a large bread box or a large microwave. And each bird, under the industry voluntary standard, and many of these companies, these producers, didn't even reach the standard, each hen had 67 square inches of space. Now, if you take an average, you know, piece of paper that you get out of a copier machine, it's 8.5 by 11. 8.5 times 11 is 93 square inches. So do a 1/3 fold of that little piece of paper, and that's the living space, 67 square inches, that the hen has for the 12 to 18 months she's alive. And she's jammed in with 5 or 7 other birds and essentially is immobilized for that period of time, never gets out of the cage. It'd be like, George, me and you and 5 other good-sized guys in a very small service elevator, unable to get out. You know, if we were in there for 15 or 20 minutes, we would start to panic. Imagine if we were in there for 24 hours or for 30 days or for a year. I mean, this somehow became an acceptable and routine practice in agriculture. And what's happening now is a correction where we're saying, you know, if we're going to raise animals for food, the very least we can do is give them sufficient space to move around. I mean, to deny them their most natural and normal behaviors is a form of privation. It's frankly a form of cruelty that should never have become acceptable, even in the smallest doses, no mind to do this to 300 million laying hens in the United States each year. And when big companies like Walmart and McDonald's, which Walmart sells 25% of all groceries in the U.S., say they're going to phase this out, they can make it work economically. For a highly cost-conscious food seller like Walmart that is trying to give good value to its customers, This is not just an extraordinary advance on animal welfare, but it tells you that doing the right thing is actually not much more expensive. It may not be any additional expense to the producer to give the animals a little bit more space.
You know, you're going up against huge conglomerates and corporations, entrenched and powerful and rich. You know, I think they portray you and other animal welfare advocates as the enemy of the family farmer, you know, the poor rancher or farmer who's barely hanging on, and that's who you're going after. There were dire predictions about the changes in regulations, I think, in California. If you enact these protections for hens and chickens, we'll all go under. Well, they did go under, in a sense. The industry went under, the egg industry went under, but not for the reason they were predicting. They went under because, you know, the chickens came home to roost, in a sense.
Well, California, I think, was really the staging ground for the big battle in contemporary times on the use of animals in agriculture. In 2008, so nearly 8 years ago, California voters had Prop 2 on their ballot. And Prop 2 said that veal calves should not be confined in crates that are 22 inches wide and, again, immobilize the animals, don't allow the young male calves to even turn around. It stipulated that breeding sows in the pig industry should not be in a 2-foot by 7-foot cage called the gestation crate for 3 years at a time. Now, these gestating sows weigh 300, 400, 500 pounds. They're in a crate that's 2 feet wide. It's about as wide as my shoulders, as wide as the, you know, average adult male shoulders. And that's it. That's all the space they get. For 3 years, these sows can take one step forward and one step back, and that's it. And then, as I mentioned, the battery cages, Prop 2, that California ballot measure in November 2008, was a measure to get the hens out of those cages. And the simple set of principles enshrined in Proposition 2 is that animals should be able to stand up, lie down, turn around, and freely extend their limbs. Now, not exactly a radical animal rights manifesto, but just kind of common decency. And giving animals conscripted into food production the opportunity to move. And as you indicated, George, you know, we were going up against these big commodity farming interests, the veal industry, the pork industry, the egg industry, plus lots of others who worried about the slippery slope. So they put millions of dollars against us. They tried to tell us that this was going to bankrupt family farms, even though most of these farms were corporate owned. They said that it was going to drive up your food prices. They even said it was going to be unsafe to raise animals outside of these cage confinement circumstances, that your food safety would be compromised. Well, the beautiful thing is that the American public, you know, often does make the right decision, and they realized that this was hokum. And at the end of the day, Prop 2 got more yes votes than any citizen ballot initiative in American history. Nearly two-thirds of voters favored that measure. And it was really a ballot measure that had immense reverberations throughout the food industry and, frankly, on animal welfare across the country. That was the beginning of the process of these big food retailers, many of which have enormous operations, of course, in California, selling operations because there are 38 million Californians. They began to say, hey, maybe the public is not aligned with us. This is the principle of my book, The Humane Economy, that businesses that have animal cruelty baked into the business model, even if it's in their supply chain, not directly in what they're doing, they're at risk because the customers in this increasingly alert period, when we know so much more about animals and we have more access to information about how they're treated on the farm or in the lab or in the wild, that customers are not going to tolerate this sort of cruelty. So what's happened in the last 10 months is 175 of the biggest names in food retail have said, we're going to stop buying eggs from operations that confine the hens. This is the humane economy in action.
As I was sort of alluding to, I mean, millions of chickens. In between the last time you were here and now, millions of chickens had to be put down because they got sick. They got sick because of the conditions under which they lived. And these eggs and the meat that people were eating also created the possibility of humans getting sick from it. So, you know, the terrible impact on the industry was their own fault, and it was probably inevitable at some point.
Well, what we say at the Humane Society of the U.S. and what I write about in the Humane Economy is that when you're bad to animals, there are often other adverse outcomes. You know, the factory farms and the extreme confinement of animals where they're jammed into cages so they can't move is obviously a serious animal welfare concern for anyone who, you know, has common sense and decency about how animals should be treated. But when you overcrowd animals, you create stress in them. You create conditions rife for the spread of disease.
We're going to pick up that issue on the other side, talking with Wayne Pacelli about his new book, The Humane Economy. Much more to come. I want to jump into the conversation about elephants and elephant welfare as well when we come back. That's from 1993's Off the Ground. Paul McCartney, Long Leather Coat is the name of the song. It's about a guy who thinks he's about to get lucky, but his long leather coat inspires something else entirely. He gets a bit of a surprise. We're talking about The Humane Economy, the title of a new book by Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S. When we come back, we'll jump into animals and entertainment, some big changes happening in that realm as well. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Wayne Pacelli, in your book, The Humane Economy, you make the argument that any business, any corporation which has animal cruelty sort of built into its bottom line, it better pay attention. And the example we discussed before the break was the egg industry, which sort of collapsed on itself because the cruelty built in caused these chickens and hens to get sick. And that in turn puts humans at risk.
It really did. And, you know, we saw big outbreaks. It was funny, after California voters said no to cage confinement of laying hens, what happened is the California legislature then said, hey, we're going to stop any sale of eggs in California. If you want to produce eggs by inhumane methods in Iowa or in Indiana, we're not going to let you sell those products here. The egg industry objected, and what happened is in Iowa, they had the biggest egg recall in American history, 500 million eggs, a salmonella outbreak because of the inhumane, overcrowded conditions. And I think that kind of clinched the case for California lawmakers who were debating the issue at the very time that outbreak in Iowa happened. So when we're good to animals, we're also good on food safety issues. These things are entwined, and you can't mistreat animals and expect the food to be safe.
You know, the slippery slope argument that you have to deal with all the time. Well, you're really, you and the Humane Society and PETA and other organizations, you really want to ban all meat. We can't eat eggs. We can't eat cheese. That's what you're really up to here.
Well, I think the voters, you know, really disproved that phony argument. You know, it's one thing to say you're going to be a vegetarian or a vegan. It's another thing to say that animals built to move, animals with legs, animals with wings, should be allowed to move around a little bit. And, you know, I think the consumers are discerning enough to make these decisions for themselves. Obviously, a lot more people are eating more plant-based foods. They're trying to eat healthier. We know that eating more fruits and vegetables, you know, from every sort of authoritative body that looks at dietary issues and offers guidelines, from the American Heart Association and the National Cancer Society, even though our own federal government is saying, let's eat more of those foods. But that, in some ways, is a separate question of whether, if animals are going to be raised for food, if they're going to be raised for meat, if they're going to be raised for eggs, for milk, they should be treated humanely. That's just decency. And, you know, George, some of these folks who make these arguments, you know, really try to make the claim, and it's a false claim, that, you know, these are traditions. Well, factory farming is not a very long tradition. It's only been happening for 50 or 60 years. For the vast majority of our American experience, and certainly for human history, we were living in agrarian societies where animals were outside, they were on pasture, they could feel sunlight on their back, they could feel soil beneath their feet. And yes, the animals were going to be slaughtered at some point, but not every day was a sort of living hell in some sort of factory farm where they couldn't move and couldn't see a ray of sunlight. Factory farming is a sort of human innovation started around 1960 that is really detached from conscience. What we want to do in this new humane economy that we want to build is have human creativity attached to conscience. We want to use human ingenuity to figure out ways to conduct our lives and to deal with animals that doesn't make victims of so many animals.
Switching gears just a little bit, another example of the humane economy deals with entertainment. I don't know anyone who doesn't like elephants. And if you've ever been, anybody who's ever been around an elephant, there's a feeling you get, you just can't escape it. So when you see these elephants living in circuses like Ringling Brothers, which is, you know, such a huge corporation, such a profitable operation, you know that there's something funny about it. We've seen the stories. I've written some of them myself about the use of bull hooks and just the lives of drudgery in chains, living in railroad cars, you know, week after week, you know, for most of the year, most of their lives. That's an example that I never thought I'd see change because of how Ringling Brothers has fought back against you, against other organizations, activists who've tried to expose the kind of things that happen to elephants. They've gone to court. They spent millions of dollars. As you note in the book, they've hired private investigators to go after people. And yet, in just the last year, everything's changed.
Yeah, this is one where, you know, really taking the kind of decades-long look at this, looking at a 30 or 40-year horizon, this issue has obviously turned around entirely. I mean, it used to be a bit of a heretical idea. It was an out-of-the-mainstream notion to criticize the circus and to criticize the treatment of the elephants, you know, partly because of all of the pomp and circumstance and, frankly, all of the propaganda that was associated with it. And, you know, kids, of course, love elephants. That's why they wanted to see the elephants. But we didn't really know the backstory. We didn't know the fact that the Asian elephants are in Detroit for 3 nights and then they're put in a railway car, and then they go to Chicago for 3 nights, and then to Milwaukee, and then to Minneapolis, and then to Bismarck, and then to Cheyenne, and to Denver. They're on the road 350 days a year. The elephants are on chains 22 hours a day. The only time they get off the chains is to walk to the arena, do the performance, and then walk back. The only reason that a 5 or 6 ton animal submits to a 180-pound person is because of fear. I mean, these are wild animals. These are not domesticated creatures. These are the dominant animals in their ecosystems in Southeast Asia. And for those elephants that, or for those circuses that have African elephants, the Africans, of course, are the dominant animals throughout Africa. And, you know, they're standing on their head, they're doing a quick pirouette. And it's because, George, as you noted, these handlers have this implement in their hands. It's called a bull hook. It's like a combination of a baseball bat and a fire poker. It's a wooden, long, hard, dense bat, if you will, with a sharp metal point at the end, and they use it to hook the animals and to hit the animals and to strike them. Now, elephants are big animals, but when you hit them with a combination of a bat and a fire poker, it hurts. And the evidence was plain. It was gathered year after year. And now what's happened is Ringling Brothers last March in 2015 shocked the world, shocked the animal welfare world for sure, and said, we're going to phase out our use of elephants over the next few years. We're going to retire them. And then, in fact, they accelerated the time frame, and on May 1st, Ringling Brothers retired the last of its elephants. And this was a huge change, symbolic change, in how we treat animals in our society.
Well, you tell the story sort of behind the scenes of Kenneth Feld and that company that owns Ringling Brothers. And, man, they dug in their heels, and it got pretty nasty.
This was
a lot of things that the public never sees.
Yeah, this is a tough CEO of Ringling Brothers. He fought the animal welfare community, HSUS and PETA and other organizations with everything he had. There were lawsuits, and there was infiltration. You know, his company hired a former deputy director of the CIA to infiltrate organizations. I mean, this was really a behind-the-scenes battle that the public did not have quite a window into, and I go into all the blows and all the dirt in my book. And it's an extraordinary story, and it shows that, you know, while it may seem like this was some sort of inevitable outcome that the elephants would get out of the circus, this was in doubt for many, many years, and I didn't think that Ken Feld would change. But what I do try to argue in the book is that these forces of the humane economy, this growing consciousness about animals, and in particular, as you indicate, George, this attention and affection and appreciation for elephants in particular, is something that is undeniable. The public is now increasingly alert. These animals are conscious. They are problem solvers. Elephants grieve for members of their families who are lost. I mean, we know so much about their intelligence and their social behavior at this point that to keep them on chains for 22 hours a day and to shuttle them around the country for silly stunts and tricks, you know, just couldn't withstand the light of day any longer. And even Ken Feld and Ringling Brothers recognized that that was not a sustainable business model. They've pivoted. And, you know, George, in Las Vegas, I mean, gosh, I write in the book that Las Vegas used to be a center of wild animal acts, and now you can't find one of them. And Cirque du Soleil dominates the acrobatic entertainment that exists in the city now.
Yeah, you can still have a great show and not rely on elephants and being cruel to elephants and other performing animals and tigers and things of that sort. What happens to the elephants now? What becomes of them? Are you keeping an eye on how they're treated after they perform?
Well, Ringling Brothers is a company that obviously has amassed a lot of wealth and capital through the years, and they've got a center in Florida where they're retiring the elephants. There are a lot of animal welfare advocates who are critical of how the animals are treated there. But I'll say, at the very least, the animals are not traveling around. They're not being shuttled in these railway cars. So we're going to do our best to keep an eye on it, but they're still in Ringling's hands. Many times when companies stop the mistreatment of animals, they turn them over to animal welfare groups, actually passing on an enormous cost to the animal welfare groups, who then have to deal with the matter of lifetime care of these creatures. Ringling Brothers is assuming the cost, but they're also retaining control of the animals. I think that issue will continue to play out some, but I think it's certainly much better for the elephants now than it's been for the last 50 years for the company. And it's a company that's used elephants for 145 years, if you can believe that.
You also tell the story in your book about the SeaWorld fight. Now, the last time you were here, it was still underway, and SeaWorld was fighting back against the wave of anger among the public in the wake of the film Blackfish that we've covered years ago on this show and which we've talked to you about several times. They were still fighting. They had dug in their heels, much like Ringling Brothers, and now, boom.
Yeah, this too, like the campaign against Ringling Brothers to get the elephants out of the traveling circus acts, the fight against SeaWorld and its use of orcas and the stunts that the orcas are doing at the theme parks, a decades-long fight. And, you know, HSUS and many other groups made their case, argued that the orcas live in family groups, that in the wild the orcas can live to more than 100 years, but the lifespans of the captive animals are much shorter. There's no way to really give the animals the enrichment and the social lives and the vibrancy that they get in the wild. And this is the dominant predator in the world. I mean, the biggest predator that exists in the oceans is the orca or the killer whale. And in March, I made an announcement with the CEO, who had really only been on the job less than a year at SeaWorld, that company was ending its breeding of orcas, is going to sunset the use of orcas, it's going to phase out the use of orcas in the theatrical shows, and essentially allow this current generation of orcas to live out their lifespans. The company also made pledges on the food side that they're going to only source products, animal products, at their theme parks for their 20 million visitors from cage-free sources. They're going to offer more plant-based options. They said they're going to put $50 million into rescue and rehabilitation. Now, for some animal advocates, that's not enough. They want the orcas out. They want them in sea pens right away. But there's no question that this is an extraordinary advance, and this is the culmination of a 30-year campaign that is now sunsetting the use of orcas. So the two biggest brands in live animal entertainment, Ringling with its elephants and SeaWorld with its orcas, they are changing, and that's because the world is waking up. And the documentary that you mentioned, George, Blackfish, was an extraordinary agent in driving this awareness.
Something else that you cover in the Humane Economy is the movie industry. And of course, you know, anybody who's watched Westerns growing up as a kid or as an adult, even you got to look at what happens to horses and figure, some of them must have got hurt. You outline some pretty specific information, though, that I had never read before about systemic sort of cruelty built into some of the movies that were probably among my favorite as a youngster. Great Westerns, amazing examples that would make most movie lovers sick.
Well, we don't know the backstory, right? I mean, obviously, what we get is the editor's cut. It's boiled down to 90 minutes or 140, you know, minutes for a long film, whatever it is. And, you know, obviously, they're not going to be talking about the backstory of animal mistreatment. But when you look at those Westerns, when you look at so many other films through the years, like Project X, where they had chimpanzees on the set. Now, the message of Project X was a film about the mistreatment of chimpanzees in, you know, by the military for experiments. But to do that, they used wild chimpanzees, and there were all sorts of cases and all sorts of evidence of mistreatment of the chimps, because how do you properly care for wild chimps on a movie set? And I think what's happened is, and this is a case where this was not necessarily the design of the people who created these tools, was to alleviate animal cruelty. But new technology, just because we humans are so creative, we developed new methods of doing our work that put the animal cruelty aside and gave us incredible filmmaking capabilities. And I talk about in the book computer-generated imagery, CGI. Avatar was a great example of this, but we also saw it with Dawn of Planet of the Apes and Rise of Planet of the Apes. These new performance capture technologies and the use of computer-generated imageries has been a revolution in filmmaking that offers us the prospect of keeping the animals at the center of the story, because animals are at the center of our human story, but not involving any animal abuse. It's just quite a remarkable advance in technology that's going to squeeze animal cruelty out of the equation.
Well, you mentioned a specific example. I mean, the greatest animal rescue of all that became a movie, a recent movie, Noah.
Yes, Darren Aronofsky, who directed Black Swan, The Wrestler, you know, many critically acclaimed films. He had a dream ever since he was a young man of telling the first rescue story ever, which is in the Bible. That's Noah's rescue of two of every kind of animal to save them from the great flood. And, you know, I spoke with Aronofsky, and I recount this in my book, and he said, you know, I could have gotten two llamas, and I could clearly get two dogs, and I could get two cats, and I could get two horses, but, you know, I'm going to run out of animals. You know, I could get 20, 30, 40 different species, but then what happens if I've got the predators and the prey together? They're going to get scared. How can I possibly do justice to this incredible narrative of Noah? And it was with CGI that computer-generated imagery allowed him to have hundreds and thousands of animals and to create vivid filmmaking and to have the animals enter the ark in a way that if he had live, real animals, it would never have achieved the sort of cinematography and the vividness and the diversity of species that he was able to work with CGI. It's not just that it was equivalent filmmaking without live animals. It's better filmmaking. And I think that was my point, that we're going to not only shed animal cruelty, but we're going to do things better in a world where we put human creativity to use and just stop the nonsense of abusing animals for whatever purpose.
I always wondered whether at the end of the movie where you see the thing, no animals were harmed in this production, whether you could count on that as being accurate or not. You addressed that as well. I guess that wasn't always the case.
No, and you know, there's a separate organization. It's not my group. My group is the Humane Society of the United States. There's another group called the American Humane Association, which has frankly drawn its share of criticism from a number of animal welfare groups for not being all that rigorous with how the animals are overseen on the set. But even if AHA had wanted to do a very good job on the issues, it would be difficult because now we've got filmmaking that's occurring in Europe, we've got filmmaking in Canada, we've got filmmaking in Asian countries. So it's difficult to chase down what's happening to the animals in all of these settings where films are done in our global economy. But then the other side of this is the animals themselves. It's not just how the animals are treated on the set. Now, you know, if a chimpanzee is being struck with a sharp object or a blunt object to try to force behavior, you know that's mistreatment. But one of the problems with these wild...
I'll tell you what, Wayne, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we'll pick up that thought on the other side. We're talking with Wayne Pacelli of the Humane Society about his new book, The Humane Economy. We'll pick up that thought, and a little bit later, we'll open up the phone lines with your questions and comments. Stick around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.